That's when you turned and glared at him. The monk in the library? My tone was disbelieving. You frightened him, not me. I've known Dom Berno since 1718, Matthew said dryly. He knows me far too well to fear me. We met at the Duke of Chandos's house party, where he was singing the role of Damon in Handel's Acis and Galatea. I assure you, it was your power and not mine that startled him. This is a human world, Matthew, not a fairy tale. Humans outnumber and fear us, and there's nothing more powerful than human fear. Not magic, not vampire strength, nothing. Fear and denial are what humans do best, Diana, but it's not a way that's open to a witch. I'm not afraid. Yes, you are, he said softly, rising to his feet, and I think it's time I took you home. Look, I said, my need for information about the manuscript pushing all other thoughts aside. We're both interested in Ashmole 782. A vampire and a witch can't be friends, but we should be able to work together. I'm not so sure, Matthew said impassively. The ride back to Oxford was quiet. Humans had it all wrong when it came to vampires, I reflected. To make them frightening, humans imagined vampires as bloodthirsty. But it was Matthew's remoteness, combined with his flashes of anger and abrupt mood swings, that scared me. When we arrived at the new college lodge, Matthew retrieved my mat from the trunk. Have a good weekend, he said without emotion. Good night, Matthew. Thank you for taking me to yoga. My voice was as devoid of expression as his, and I resolutely refused to look back, even though his cold eyes watched me walk away. Chapter 9. Matthew crossed the River Avon. Driving over the bridge's high, arched spans, he found the familiar Lanarkshire landscape of craggy hills, dark sky, and stark contrasts soothing. Little about this part of Scotland was soft or inviting, and its forbidding beauty suited his present mood. He downshifted through the lime alley that had once led to a palace and now led nowhere, an odd remnant of a grand life no one wanted to live anymore. Pulling up to what had once been the back entrance of an old hunting lodge, where rough brown stone stood in sharp contrast to the creamy stuccoed front, he climbed out of his Jaguar and lifted his bag from the trunk. The lodge's welcoming white door opened. You look like hell. A wiry demon with dark hair, twinkling brown eyes, and a hooked nose stood with his hand on the latch and inspected his best friend from head to foot. Hamish Osborne had met Matthew Claremont at Oxford nearly 20 years ago. Like most creatures, they'd been taught to fear each other and were uncertain how to behave. The two became inseparable once they'd realized they shared a similar sense of humor and the same passion for ideas. Matthew's face registered anger and resignation in quick succession. "Nice to see you, too," he said gruffly, dropping his bags by the door. He drank in the house's cold, clear smell, with its nuances of old plaster and aging wood, and Hamish's unique aroma of lavender and peppermint. The vampire was desperate to get the smell of the witch out of his nose. Jordan, Hamish's human butler, appeared silently and brought with him the scent of lemon furniture polish and starch. It didn't drive Diana's honeysuckle and whorehound entirely from Matthew's nostrils, but it helped. "Good to see you, sir," he said, before heading for the stairs with Matthew's bags. Jordan was a butler of the old school. Even had he not been paid handsomely to keep his employer's secrets, he would never divulge to a soul that Osborne was a demon, or that he sometimes entertained vampires. It would be as unthinkable as letting slip that he was occasionally asked to serve peanut butter and banana sandwiches at breakfast. "Thank you, Jordan." Matthew surveyed the downstairs hall so that he wouldn't have to meet Hamish's eyes. "You've picked up a new Hamilton, I see." He stared raptly at the unfamiliar landscape on the far wall. "You don't usually notice my new acquisitions." Like Matthew's, Hamish's accent was mostly Oxbridge with a touch of something else. In his case, it was the burr of Glasgow's streets. "Speaking of new acquisitions, how is sweet William?" William was Hamish's new lover, a human so adorable and easygoing that Matthew had nicknamed him after a spring flower. It stuck. Now Hamish used it as an endearment, and William had started bothering florists in the city for pots of it to give to friends. "Grumpy," Hamish said with a chuckle. "I promised him a quiet weekend at home." "You didn't have to come, you know. I didn't expect it." Matthew sounded grumpy too. "Yes, I know, but it's been a while since we've seen each other. And Cadzel is beautiful this time of year." Matthew glowered at Hamish, disbelief evident on his face. "Christ, you do need to go hunting, don't you?" was all Hamish could say. "Badly," the vampire replied, his voice clipped. "Do you have time for a drink first, or do you need to get straight to it?" "I believe I can manage a drink," Matthew said in a withering tone. "Excellent. I've got a bottle of wine for you and some whiskey for me." Hamish had asked Jordan to pull some of the good wine out of the cellar shortly after he'd received Matthew's dawn call. He hated to drink alone, and Matthew refused to touch whiskey.
"Then you can tell me why you have such an urgent need to go hunting this fine September weekend."
Hamish led the way across the gleaming floors and upstairs to his library. The warm brown paneling had been added in the 19th century, ruining the architect's original intention to provide an airy, spacious place for 18th-century ladies to wait while their husbands busied themselves with sport. The original white ceiling remained, festooned with plaster garlands and busy angels, a constant reproach to modernity. The two men settled into the leather chairs that flanked the fireplace, where a cheerful blaze was already taking the edge off the autumn chill. Hamish showed Matthew the bottle of wine, and the vampire made an appreciative sound.
"That will do nicely."
"I should think so. The gentleman at Barry Brothers Inn Road assured me it was excellent."
Hamish poured the wine and pulled the stopper from his decanter. Glasses in hand, the two men sat in companionable silence.
"I'm sorry to drag you into all this," Matthew began. "I'm in a difficult situation. It's complicated."
Hamish chuckled. "It always is with you." Matthew had been drawn to Hamish Osborne in part because of his directness, and in part because, unlike most demons, he was level-headed and difficult to unsettle. Over the years, a number of the vampire's friends had been demons, gifted and cursed in equal measure. Hamish was far more comfortable to be around. There were no blazing arguments, bursts of wild activity, or dangerous depressions. Time with Hamish consisted of long stretches of silence, followed by blindingly sharp conversation, all colored by his serene approach to life. Hamish's differences extended to his work, which was not in the usual demonic pursuits of art or music. Instead, he had a gift for money, for making it and for spotting fatal weaknesses in international financial instruments and markets. He took a demon's characteristic creativity and applied it to spreadsheets rather than sonatas, understanding the intricacies of currency exchange with such remarkable precision that he was consulted by presidents, monarchs, and prime ministers. The demon's uncommon predilection for the economy fascinated Matthew, as did his ease among humans. Hamish loved being around them and found their faults stimulating rather than aggravating. It was a legacy of his childhood, with an insurance broker for a father and a housewife as a mother. Having met the unflappable Osbornes, Matthew could understand Hamish's fondness. The crackling of the fire and the smooth smell of whiskey in the air began to do their work, and the vampire found himself relaxing. Matthew sat forward, holding his wine glass lightly between his fingers, the red liquid winking in the firelight.
"I don't know where to begin," he said shakily.
"At the end, of course. Why did you pick up the phone and call me?"
"I needed to get away from a witch."
Hamish watched his friend for a moment, noting Matthew's obvious agitation. Somehow Hamish was certain the witch wasn't male.
"What makes this witch so special?" he asked quietly. Matthew looked up from under his heavy brows.
"Everything." "Oh, you are in trouble, aren't you?"
Hamish's bird deepened in sympathy and amusement. Matthew laughed unpleasantly.
"You could say that, yes."
"Does this witch have a name?"
"Diana. She's a historian. And American."
"The goddess of the hunt," Hamish said slowly.
Apart from her ancient name, is she an ordinary witch?
No, Matthew said abruptly. She is far from ordinary.
Ah, the complications.
Hamish studied his friend's face for signs that he was calming down, but saw that Matthew was spoiling for a fight instead.
She's a bishop.
Matthew waited. He'd learned that it was never a good idea to anticipate that the demon wouldn't grasp the significance of a reference, no matter how obscure. Hamish sifted and sorted through his mind and found what he was seeking.
As in Salem, Massachusetts?
Matthew nodded grimly. She's the last of the bishop witches. Her father is a proctor. The demon whistled softly.
A witch twice over with a distinguished magical lineage. You never do things by half, do you? She must be powerful.
Her mother is. I don't know much about her father. Rebecca Bishop, though, that's a different story. She was doing spells at 13 that most witches can't manage after a lifetime of study and experience, and her childhood abilities as a seer were astonishing.
Do you know her, Matt? Hamish had to ask.
Matthew had lived many lives and crossed paths with too many people for his friend to keep track of them all.
Matthew shook his head. No, there's always talk about her, though, and plenty of envy. You know how witches are, he said, his voice taking on the slightly unpleasant tone it did whenever he referred to the species.
Hamish let the remark about witches pass and eyed Matthew over the rim of his glass.
And Diana?
She claims she doesn't use magic.
There were two threads in that brief sentence that needed pulling. Hamish tugged on the easier one first.
What? Not for anything?
Finding a lost earring coloring her hair?
Hamish sounded doubtful.
She's not the earrings and colored hair type. She's more the 3-mile run followed by an hour on the river in a dangerously tiny boat type.
With her background, I find it difficult to believe she never uses her power.
Hamish was a pragmatist as well as a dreamer. It was why he was so good with other people's money.
And you don't believe it either, or you wouldn't suggest that she's lying.
There was the second thread pulled.
She says she only uses magic occasionally, for little things.
Matthew hesitated, raked his fingers through his hair so half of it stood on end, and took a gulp of wine.
I've been watching her, though, and she's using it more than that. I can smell it, he said, his voice frank and open for the first time since his arrival.
The scent is like an electrical storm about to break, or summer lightning. There are times when I can see it, too. Diana shimmers when she's angry or lost in her work.
And when she's asleep, he thought, frowning.
Christ, there are times when I think I can even taste it.
She shimmers.
It's nothing you would see, though you might sense the energy some other way.
The chatoiement, her witch's shimmer, is very faint. Even when I was a young vampire, only the most powerful witches emitted these tiny pulses of light. It's rare to see it today. Diana's unaware she's doing it, and she's oblivious to its significance.
Matthew shuddered and balled up his fist. The demon glanced at his watch. The day was young, but he already knew why his friend was in Scotland.
Matthew Claremont was falling in love.
Jordan came in, his timing impeccable.
The gillie dropped off the jeep, sir. I told him you wouldn't need his services today.
The butler knew there was little need for a guide to track down deer when you had a vampire in the house.
Excellent,
Hamish said, rising to his feet and draining his glass. He sorely wanted more whiskey, but it was better to keep his wits about him. Matthew looked up.
I'll go out by myself, Hamish. I'd rather hunt alone.
The vampire didn't like hunting with warm bloods, a category that included humans, demons, and witches. He usually made an exception for Hamish, but today he wanted to be on his own while he got his craving for Diana Bishop under control.
Oh, we're not going hunting, Hamish said with a wicked glint in his eyes. We're going stalking.
The demon had a plan. It involved occupying his friend's mind until he let down his guard and willingly shared what was going on in Oxford, rather than requiring Hamish to drag it out of him.
Come on, it's a beautiful day. You'll have fun.
Outside, Matthew grimly climbed into Hamish's beat-up jeep. It was what the two of them preferred to roam around in when they were at Casdo, even though a Land Rover was the vehicle of choice in grand Scottish hunting lodges.
Matthew didn't mind that it was freezing to drive in, and Hamish found its hypermasculinity amusing.
In the hills, Hamish ground the jeep's gears. The vampire cringed at the sound each time as he climbed to where the deer grazed.
Matthew spotted a pair of stags next to the crag and told Hamish to stop. He got out of the jeep quietly and crouched by the front tire, already mesmerized.
Hamish smiled and joined him.
The demon had stalked deer with Matthew before and understood what he needed. The vampire didn't always feed, though today Hamish was certain that, left to his own devices, Matthew would have come home sated after dark, and there would be two fewer stags on the estate. His friend was as much predator as carnivore. It was the hunt that defined vampires' identity, not their feeding or what they fed upon. Sometimes when Matthew was restless, he just went out and tracked whatever he could chase without making a kill. While the vampire watched the deer, the demon watched Matthew. There was trouble in Oxford. He could feel it. Matthew sat patiently for the next several hours, considering whether the stags were worth pursuing. Through his extraordinary senses of smell, sight, and hearing, he tracked their movements, figured out their habits, and gauged their every response to a crackling twig or a bird in flight. The vampire's attention was avid, but he never showed impatience. For Matthew, the crucial moment came when his prey acknowledged that it was beaten and surrendered. The light was dimming when he finally rose and nodded to Hamish. It was enough for the first day, and though he didn't need the light to see the deer, he knew that Hamish needed it to get back down the mountain. By the time they reached the lodge, it was pitch black, and Jordan had turned on every lamp, which made the building look even more ridiculous, sitting on a rise in the middle of nowhere.
"This lodge never did make any sense," Matthew said in a conversational tone that was nevertheless intended to sting.
"Robert Adam was insane to take the commission."
"You've shared your thoughts on my little extravagance many times, Matthew," Hamish said serenely, "and I don't care if you understand the principles of architectural design better than I do, or whether you believe that Adam was a madman to construct, what do you always call it? An ill-conceived folly in the Lanarkshire wildness. I love it, and nothing you say is going to change that."
They'd had versions of this conversation regularly since Hamish's announcement he'd purchased the lodge, complete with all its furnishings, the ghillie and Jordan, from an aristocrat who had no use for the building and no money to repair it. Matthew had been horrified. To Hamish, however, Cadzo Lodge was a sign that he had risen so far above his Glasgow roots that he could spend money on something impractical that he could love for its own sake. Matthew said with a scowl. Grumpiness was preferable to agitation, Hamish thought. He moved on to the next step of his plan.
"Dinner's at 8, he said, "in the dining room."
Matthew hated the dining room, which was grand, high-ceilinged, and drafty. More important, it upset the vampire because it was gaudy and feminine. It was Hamish's favorite room. Matthew groaned.
"I'm not hungry."
"You're famished," Hamish said sharply, taking in the color and texture of Matthew's skin. "When was your last real meal?"
"Weeks ago."
Matthew shrugged with his usual disregard for the passage of time. "I can't remember."
"Tonight you're having wine and soup. Tomorrow it's up to you what you eat. Do you want some time alone before dinner, or will you risk playing billiards with me?"
Hamish was extremely good at billiards, and even better at snooker, which he had learned to play as a teenager. He'd made his first money in Glasgow's billiard halls and could beat almost anyone. Matthew refused to play snooker with him anymore on the grounds that it was no fun to lose every time, even to a friend. The vampire had tried to teach him carambole instead, the old French game involving balls and cues, but Matthew always won those games. Billiards was the sensible compromise. Unable to resist a battle of any sort, Matthew agreed.
"I'll change and join you."
Hamish's felt-covered billiards table was in a room opposite the library. He was there in a sweater and trousers when Matthew arrived in a white shirt and jeans. The vampire avoided wearing white, which made him look startling and ghostly, but it was the only decent shirt he had with him. He'd packed for a hunting trip, not a dinner party. He picked up his cue and stood at the end of the table.
"Ready?"
Hamish nodded.
Let's say an hour of play, shall we? Then we'll go down for a drink. The two men bent over their cues.
Be gentle with me, Matthew, Hamish murmured just before they struck the balls. The vampire snorted as they shot to the far end, hit the cushion, and rebounded.
I'll take the white, Matthew said when the ball stopped rolling and his was closest. He palmed the other and tossed it to Hamish. The demon put a red ball on its mark and stood back. As in hunting, Matthew was in no rush to score points. He shot 15 hazards in a row, putting the red ball in a different pocket each time.
If you don't mind, he drawled, pointing to the table.
The demon put his yellow ball on it without comment. Matthew mixed up simple shots that took the red ball into the pockets with trickier shots known as cannons that were not his forte. Cannons involved hitting both Hamish's yellow ball and the red ball with one strike of the cue, and they required not only strength, but finesse.
Where did you find the witch?
Hamish asked casually after Matthew cannoned the yellow and red balls. Matthew retrieved the white ball and prepared for his next shot.
The Bodleian.
The demon's eyebrows rose in surprise.
The Bodleian? Since when have you been a regular at the library?
Matthew fouled, his white ball hopping over the cushion and onto the floor.
Since I was at a concert and overheard two witches talking about an American who'd got her hands on a long-lost manuscript, he said, I couldn't figure out why the witches would give a damn.
He stepped back from the table, annoyed at his error. Hamish quickly played his 15 hazards. Matthew placed his ball on the table and picked up the chalk to mark down Hamish's score.
So you just strolled in there and struck up a conversation with her to find out?
The demon pocketed all three balls with a single shot.
I went looking for her, yes.
Matthew watched while Hamish moved around the table. I was curious.
Was she happy to see you?
Hamish asked mildly, making another tricky shot. He knew that vampires, witches, and demons seldom mixed. They preferred to spend time within close-knit circles of similar creatures. His friendship with Matthew was a relative rarity, and Hamish's demonic friends thought it was madness to let a vampire get so close. On a night like this one, he thought they might have a point.
Not exactly.
Diana was frightened at first, even though she met my eyes without flinching. Her eyes are extraordinary. Blue and gold and green and grey, Matthew mused. Later she wanted to hit me. She smelled so angry. Hamish bit back a laugh.
Sounds like a reasonable response to being ambushed by a vampire in the Bodleian.
He decided to be kind to Matthew and save him from a reply. The demon shot his yellow ball over the red, deliberately nicking it just enough that the red ball drifted forward and collided with it.
Damn, he groaned, a foul.
Matthew returned to the table, shot a few hazards and tried a cannon or two.
Have you seen each other outside the library?
Hamish asked when the vampire had regained some of his composure.
I don't see her much actually even in the library. I sit in one part and she sits in another. I've taken her to breakfast, though, and to the old lodge to meet Amira.
Hamish kept his jaw closed with difficulty. Matthew had known women for years without taking them to the old lodge. And what was this about sitting at opposite ends of the library?
Wouldn't it be easier to sit next to her in the library if you're interested in her?
I'm not interested in her.
Matthew's cue exploded into the white ball.
I want the manuscript. I've been trying to get my hands on it for more than 100 years. She just put in the slip and it came up from the stacks.
His voice was envious.
What manuscript, Matt?
Hamish was doing his best to be patient, but the exchange was rapidly becoming unendurable. Matthew was giving out information like a miser parting with pennies. It was intensely aggravating for a quick-minded demon to deal with creatures who didn't consider any division of time smaller than a decade particularly important.
An alchemical book that belonged to Elias Ashmole. Diana Bishop is a highly respected historian of alchemy.
Matthew fouled again by striking the balls too hard. Hamish re-spotted the balls and continued to rack up points while his friend simmered down. Finally, Jordan came to tell them that drinks were available downstairs.
What's the score?
Hamish peered at the chalk marks. He knew he'd won, but the gentlemanly thing was to ask. or so Matthew had told him. "You won, of course." Matthew stalked out of the room and pounded down the stairs at considerably more than a human pace. Jordan eyed the polished treads with concern.
"Professor Claremont is having a difficult day, Jordan."
"So it would seem," the butler murmured.
"Better bring up another bottle of red. It's going to be a long night."
They had their drinks in what had once been the lodge's reception area. Its windows looked out on the gardens, which were still kept in orderly, classical parterres, despite the fact that their proportions were all wrong for a hunting lodge. They were too grand. They belonged to a palace, not a folly. In front of the fireplace, drinks in hand, Hamish could at last press his way into the heart of the mystery.
"Tell me about this manuscript of Diana's, Matthew. It contains what, exactly? The recipe for the Philosopher's Stone that turns lead into gold?"
Hamish's voice was lightly mocking.
"Instructions on how to concoct the elixir of life so you can transform mortal into immortal flesh?"
The demon stopped his teasing the instant Matthew's eyes rose to meet his.
"You aren't serious," Hamish whispered, his voice shocked. "The Philosopher's Stone was just a legend, like the Holy Grail or Atlantis. It couldn't possibly be real."
Belatedly, he realized that vampires, demons, and witches weren't supposed to be real either.
"Do I look like I'm joking?" Matthew asked.
"No."
The demon shuddered. Matthew had always been convinced that he could use his scientific skills to figure out what made vampires resistant to death and decay. The Philosopher's Stone fit neatly into those dreams.
"It's the lost book," Matthew said grimly. "I know it."
Like most creatures, Hamish had heard the stories. One version suggested the witches had stolen a precious book from the vampires, a book that held the secret of immortality. Another claimed the vampires had snatched an ancient spellbook from the witches and then lost it. Some whispered that it wasn't a spellbook at all, but a primer covering the basic traits of all four humanoid species on Earth. Matthew had his own theories about what the book might contain. An explanation of why vampires were so difficult to kill, and accounts of early human and creature history were only a small part of it.
"You really think this alchemical manuscript is your book?" he asked. When Matthew nodded, Hamish let out his breath with a sigh. No wonder the witches were gossiping. How did they discover Diana had found it?
Matthew turned, ferocious.
Who knows or cares? The problems began when they couldn't keep their mouths shut.
Hamish was reminded once again that Matthew and his family really didn't like witches.
I wasn't the only one to overhear them on Sunday. Other vampires did too. And then the demon sensed that something interesting was happening, and...
Now Oxford is crawling with creatures, the demon finished. What a mess. Isn't Tarm about to start? The humans will be next. They're about to return in droves.
It gets worse.
Matthew's expression was grim.
The manuscript wasn't simply lost. It was under a spell and Diana broke it. Then she sent it back to the stacks and shows no interest in recalling it. And I'm not the only one waiting for her to do so.
Matthew, Hamish said, voice tense, are you protecting her from other witches?
She doesn't seem to recognize her own power. It puts her at risk. I couldn't let them get to her first.
Matthew seemed suddenly, disconcertingly vulnerable.
Oh, Matt, Hamish said, shaking his head. You shouldn't interfere between Diana and her own people. You'll only cause more trouble. Besides, he continued, no witch will be openly hostile to a bishop. Her family's too old and distinguished.
Nowadays, creatures no longer killed one another except in self-defense. Aggression was frowned on in their world. Matthew had told Hamish what it was like in the old days, when blood feuds and vendettas had raged, and creatures were constantly catching human attention.
The demons are disorganized, and the vampires won't dare to cross me. But the witches can't be trusted.
Matthew rose, taking his wine to the fireplace.
Let Diana Bishop be, Hamish advised. Besides, if this manuscript is bewitched, you're not going to be able to examine it.
I will if she helps me,
Matthew said, in a deceptively easy tone, staring into the fireplace.
Matthew,
the demon said in the same voice he used to let his junior partners know when they were on thin ice. Leave the witch and the manuscript alone. The vampire placed his wine glass carefully on the mantel and turned away.
I don't think I can, Hamish. I'm craving her.
Even saying the word made the hunger spread. When his hunger focused, grew insistent like this, not just any blood would do. His body demanded something more specific. If he could only taste it, taste Diana, he would be satisfied and the painful longing would subside. Hamish studied Matthew's tense shoulders. He wasn't surprised that his friend craved Diana Bishop. A vampire had to desire another creature more than anyone or anything else in order to mate, and cravings were rooted in desire. Hamish strongly suspected that Matthew, despite his previous fervent declarations that he was incapable of finding anyone who would stir that kind of feeling, was mating.
Then the real problem you're facing at the moment is not the witches, nor Diana, and it's certainly not some ancient manuscript that may or may not hold the answers to your questions.
Hamish let his words sink in before continuing.
You do realize you're hunting her.
The vampire exhaled, relieved that it had been said aloud.
I know. I climbed into her window when she was sleeping. I follow her when she's running. She resists my attempts to help her, and the more she does, the hungrier I feel.
He looked so perplexed that Hamish had to bite the inside of his lip to keep from smiling. Matthew's women didn't usually resist him. They did what he told them to do, dazzled by his good looks and charm. No wonder he was fascinated.
But I don't need Diana's blood, not physically. I won't give in to this craving. Being around her needn't be a problem.
Matthew's face crumpled unexpectedly.
What am I saying? We can't be near each other. We'll attract attention.
Not necessarily. We've spent a fair bit of time together and no one has been bothered, Hamish pointed out.
In the early years of their friendship, the two had struggled to mask their differences from curious eyes. They were brilliant enough separately to attract human interest. When they were together, their dark heads bent to share a joke at dinner, or sitting in the quadrangle in the early hours of the morning with empty champagne bottles at their feet, they were impossible to ignore.
It's not the same thing and you know it, Matthew said impatiently.
Oh yes, I forgot.
Hamish's temper snapped.
Nobody cares what demons do, but the vampire and the witch, that's important. You're the creatures who really matter in this world.
Hamish, Matthew protested, you know that's not how I feel.
You have the characteristic vampire contempt for demons, Matthew. Witches too, I might add. Think long and hard how you feel about other creatures before you take this witch to bed.
I've no intention of taking Diana to bed, Matthew said, his voice acid.
Dinner is served, sir.
Jordan had been standing in the doorway, unobserved for some time.
Thank God, Hamish said with relief, getting up from his chair.
The vampire was easier to manage if he was dividing his attention between the conversation and something, anything else. Seated in the dining room at one end of a vast table designed to feed a house party's worth of guests, Hamish tucked into the first of several courses while Matthew toyed with a soup spoon until his meal cooled. The vampire leaned over the bowl and sniffed.
"Mushrooms and sherry?" he asked.
"Yes. Jordan wanted to try something new, and since it didn't contain anything you find objectionable, I let him."
Matthew didn't ordinarily require much in the way of supplemental sustenance at Cadzo Lodge, but Jordan was a wizard with soup, and Hamish didn't like to eat alone any more than he liked drinking alone.
"I'm sorry, Hamish," Matthew said, watching his friend eat.
"I accept your apology, Matt," Hamish said, the soup spoon hovering near his mouth. "But you cannot imagine how difficult it is to accept being a demon or a witch. With vampires, it's definite and incontrovertible. You're not a vampire, and then you are. No question, no room for doubt. The rest of us have to wait, watch, and wonder. It makes your vampire superiority doubly hard to take."
Matthew was twirling the spoon's handle in his fingers like a baton.
"Witches know they're witches. They're not like demons at all," he said with a frown.
Hamish put his spoon down with a clatter and topped off his wine glass.
You know full well that having a witch for a parent is no guarantee. You can turn out perfectly ordinary. Or you can set your crib on fire. There's no telling if, when, or how your powers are going to manifest.
Unlike Matthew, Hamish had a friend who was a witch. Janine did his hair, which had never looked better, and made her own skin lotion, which was nothing short of miraculous. He suspected that witchcraft was involved.
It's not a total surprise, though, Matthew persisted, scooping some soup into his spoon and waving it slightly to cool it further. Diana has centuries of family history to rely upon. It's nothing like what you went through as a teenager.
I had a breeze of a time, Hamish said,
recalling some of the demonic coming-of-age stories he'd been privy to over the years. When Hamish was 12, his life had gone topsy-turvy in the space of one afternoon. He had come to realize, over the long Scottish autumn, that he was far smarter than his teachers. Most children who reach 12 suspect this, but Hamish knew it with deeply upsetting certainty. He responded by feigning sickness so he could skip school, and, when that no longer worked, by doing his schoolwork as rapidly as he could and abandoning all pretense of normalcy. In desperation, his schoolmaster sent for someone from the university mathematics department to evaluate Hamish's troublesome ability to solve, in minutes, problems that occupied his schoolmates for a week or more. Jack Watson, a young demon from the University of Glasgow with red hair and brilliant blue eyes, took one look at elfin Hamish Osborne and suspected that he, too, was a demon. After going through the motions of a formal evaluation, which produced the expected documentary proof that Hamish was a mathematical prodigy whose mind did not fit within normal parameters, Watson invited him to attend lectures at the university. He also explained to the headmaster that the child couldn't be accommodated within a normal classroom without becoming a pyromaniac or something equally destructive. After that, Watson made a visit to the Osbournes' modest home and told an astonished family how the world worked and exactly what kinds of creatures were in it. Percy Osborne, who came from a staunch Presbyterian background, resisted the notion of multiple supernatural and preternatural creatures, until his wife pointed out that he had been raised to believe in witches. Why not demons and vampires, too? Hamish wept with relief, no longer feeling utterly alone. His mother hugged him fiercely and told him she had always known he was special. While Watson was still sitting in front of their electric fire drinking tea with her husband and son, Jessica Osborne thought she might as well take the opportunity to broach other aspects of Hamish's life that might make him feel different. She informed her son over chocolate biscuits that she also knew he was unlikely to marry the girl next door, who was infatuated with him. Instead, Hamish was drawn to the girl's elder brother, a strapping lad of 15 who could kick a football farther than anyone else in the neighborhood. Neither Percy nor Jack seemed remotely surprised or distressed by the revelation.
Still, Matthew said now, after his first sip of tepid soup, Diana's whole family must have expected her to be a witch, and she is, whether she uses her magic or not. I should think that would be every bit as bad as being among a bunch of clueless humans. Can you imagine the pressure? Not to mention the awful sense that your life didn't belong to you. Hamish shuddered. I'd prefer blind ignorance. What did it feel like? Matthew asked hesitantly. The first day you woke up knowing you were a demon. The vampire didn't normally ask such personal questions.
Like being reborn, Hamish said. It was every bit as powerful and confusing as when you woke up craving blood and hearing the grass grow, blade by blade. Everything looked different. Everything felt different. Most of the time I smiled like a fool who'd won the lottery. The rest of the time I cried in my room. But I don't think I believed it, you know, really believed it, until you smuggled me into the hospital.
Matthew's first birthday present to Hamish, after they became friends, had involved a bottle of Krug and a trip to the John Radcliffe. There, Matthew sent Hamish through the MRI while the vampire asked him a series of questions. Afterward, they compared Hamish's scans with those of an eminent brain surgeon on the staff, both of them drinking champagne and the demon still in a surgical gown.
Hamish made Matthew play the scans back repeatedly, fascinated by the way his brain lit up like a pinball machine, even when he was replying to basic questions. It remained the best birthday present he'd ever received.
"From what you've told me, Diana is where I was before that MRI," Hamish said. "She knows she's a witch, but she still feels she's living a lie."
"She is living a lie," Matthew growled, taking another sip of soup. "Diana's pretending she's human."
"Wouldn't it be interesting to know why that's the case? More important, can you be around someone like that? You don't like lies."
Matthew looked thoughtful but didn't respond.
"There's something else," Hamish continued. "For someone who dislikes lies as much as you do, you keep a lot of secrets. If you need this witch, for whatever reason, you're going to have to win her trust. And the only way to do that is by telling her things you don't want her to know. She's roused your protective instincts, and you're going to have to fight them."
While Matthew mulled the situation over, Hamish turned the conversation to the latest catastrophes in the city and the government. The vampire calmed further, caught up in the intricacies of finance and policy.
"You've heard about the murders in Westminster, I presume," Hamish said when Matthew was completely at ease.
"I have. Somebody needs to put a stop to it."
"You?" Hamish asked.
"It's not my job. Yet."
Hamish knew that Matthew had a theory about the murders, one that was linked to his scientific research.
"You still think the murders are a sign that vampires are dying out?"
"Yes," Matthew said.
Matthew was convinced that creatures were slowly becoming extinct. Hamish had dismissed his friend's hypotheses at first, but he was beginning to think Matthew might be right. They returned to less disturbing topics of conversation, and after dinner retreated upstairs. The demon had divided one of the lodge's redundant reception rooms into a sitting room and a bedroom. The sitting room was dominated by a large ancient chessboard with carved ivory and ebony pieces that by all rights should be in a museum under protective glass rather than in a drafty hunting lodge. Like the MRI, the chess set had been a present from Matthew. Their friendship had deepened over long evenings like this one, spent playing chess and discussing their work. One night, Matthew began to tell Hamish stories of his past exploits. Now there was little about Matthew Claremont that the demon didn't know, and the vampire was the only creature Hamish had ever met who wasn't frightened of his powerful intellect. Hamish, as was his custom, sat down behind the black pieces.
"Did we finish our last game?" Matthew asked, feigning surprise at the neatly arranged board.
"Yes, you won," Hamish said curtly, earning one of his friend's rare, broad smiles. The two began to move their pieces, Matthew taking his time and Hamish moving swiftly and decisively when it was his turn. There was no sound except for the crackle of the fire and the ticking of the clock. After an hour of play, Hamish moved to the final stage of his plan.
"I have a question."
His voice was careful as he waited for his friend to make his next move.
"Do you want the witch for herself, or for her power over that manuscript?"
"I don't want her power," Matthew exploded, making a bad decision with his rook, which Hamish quickly captured. He bowed his head, looking more than ever like a Renaissance angel focused on some celestial mystery.
"Christ, I don't know what I want."
Hamish sat as still as possible.
"I think you do, Matt."
Matthew moved a pawn and made no reply.
"The other creatures in Oxford," Hamish continued, "they'll know soon if they don't know already that you're interested in more than this old book. What's your end game?"
"I don't know," the vampire whispered.
"Love? Tasting her? Making her like you?"
Matthew snarled.
"Very impressive," Hamish said in a bored tone.
"There's a lot I don't understand about all this, Hamish, but there are three things I do know," Matthew said emphatically, picking up his wine glass from the floor by his feet. "I won't give in to this craving for her blood. I don't want to control her power, and I certainly have no wish to make her a vampire." He shuddered at the thought.
"That leaves love. You have your answer then. You do know what you want."
Matthew swallowed a gulp of wine.
I want what I shouldn't want, and I crave someone I can never have.
You're not afraid you'd hurt her? Hamish asked gently. You've had relationships with warm-blooded women before, and you've never harmed any of them.
Matthew's heavy crystal wine goblet snapped in two. The bowl toppled to the floor, red wine spreading on the carpet. Hamish saw the glint of powdered glass between the vampire's index finger and thumb.
Oh, Matt, why didn't you tell me?
Hamish governed his features, making sure that not a particle of his shock was evident.
How could I?
Matthew stared at his hands and ground the shards between his fingertips until they sparkled reddish-black from the mixture of glass and blood. You always had too much faith in me, you know.
Who was she?
Her name was Eleanor. Matthew stumbled over the name. He dashed the back of his hand across his eyes, a fruitless attempt to wipe the image of her face from his mind. My brother and I were fighting. Now I can't even remember what the argument was about. Back then I wanted to destroy him with my bare hands. Eleanor tried to make me see reason. She got between us and... The vampire's voice broke. He cradled his head without bothering to clean the bloody residue from his already healed fingers. I loved her so much, and I killed her.
When was this? Hamish whispered.
Matthew lowered his hands, turning them over to study his long, strong fingers.
Ages ago, yesterday. What does it matter? He asked, with a vampire's disregard for time.
It matters enormously if you made this mistake when you were a newly minted vampire and not in control of your instincts and your hunger.
Ah, then it will also matter that I killed another woman, Cecilia Martin, just over a century ago. I wasn't a newly minted vampire then.
Matthew got up from his chair and walked to the windows. He wanted to run into the night's blackness and disappear so he wouldn't have to see the horror in Hamish's eyes.
Are there more? Hamish asked sharply.
Matthew shook his head.
Two is enough. There can't be a third. Not ever.
Tell me about Cecilia, Hamish commanded, leaning forward in his chair.
She was a banker's wife, Matthew said reluctantly. I saw her at the opera and became infatuated.
Everyone in Paris was infatuated with someone else's wife at the time. His finger traced the outline of a woman's face on the pane of glass before him. It didn't strike me as a challenge. I only wanted a taste of her that night I went to her house. But once I started, I couldn't stop. And yet I couldn't let her die, either. She was mine, and I wouldn't give her up. I barely stopped feeding in time. Dear, she hated being a vampire. Cecilia walked into a burning house before I could stop her.
Hamish frowned.
Then you didn't kill her, Matt. You killed herself.
I fed on her until she was at the brink of death, forced her to drink my blood, and turned her into a creature without her permission because I was selfish and scared, he said furiously. In what way did I not kill her? I took her life, her identity, her vitality. That's death, Hamish.
Why did you keep this from me? Hamish tried not to care that his best friend had done so, but it was difficult.
Even vampires feel shame. Matthew said tightly. I hate myself, and I should, for what I did to those women.
This is why you have to stop keeping secrets, Matt. They're going to destroy you from the inside. Hamish thought about what he wanted to say before he continued. You didn't set out to kill Eleanor and Cecilia. You're not a murderer.
Matthew rested his fingertips on the white painted window frame and pressed his forehead against the cold panes of glass. When he spoke, his voice was flat and dead.
No, I'm a monster. Eleanor forgave me for it. Cecilia never did.
You're not a monster, Hamish said, worried by Matthew's tone.
Maybe not, but I am dangerous.
He turned and faced Hamish,
especially around Diana. Not even Eleanor made me feel this way.
The mere thought of Diana brought the craving back, the tightness spreading from his heart to his abdomen. His face darkened with the effort to bring it under control.
Come back here and finish this game, Hamish said, his voice rough.
I could go, Hamish, Matthew said uncertainly. You don't have to share your roof with me.
Don't be an idiot, Hamish replied as quick as a whip.
You're not going anywhere.
Matthew sat.
I don't understand how you can know about Eleanor and Cecilia not hate me too, he said after a few minutes.
I can't conceive of what you would have to do to make me hate you, Matthew. I love you like a brother, and I will until I draw my last breath.
Thank you, Matthew said, his face somber. I'll try to deserve it.
Don't try. Do it, Hamish said gruffly. You're about to lose your bishop, by the way.
The two creatures dragged their attention back to the game with difficulty, and they were still playing in the early morning when Jordan brought up coffee for Hamish and a bottle of port for Matthew. The butler picked up the ruined wine glass without comment, and Hamish sent him off to bed. When Jordan was gone, Hamish surveyed the board and made his final move. Checkmate.
Matthew let out his breath and sat back in his chair, staring at the chessboard.
His queen stood encircled by his own pieces, pawns, a knight, and a rook. Across the board, his king was checked by a lowly black pawn. The game was over, and he had lost.
There's more to the game than protecting your queen, Hamish said. Why do you find it so difficult to remember that it's the king who's not expendable?
The king just sits there, moving one square at a time. The queen can move so freely. I suppose I'd rather lose the game than forfeit her freedom. Hamish wondered if he was talking about chess or Diana. Is she worth the cost, Matt? He asked softly.
Yes, Matthew said, without a moment of hesitation, lifting the white queen from the board and holding it between his fingers.
I thought so, Hamish said. You don't feel this way now, but you're lucky to have found her at last.
The vampire's eyes glittered, and his mouth twisted into a crooked smile.
But is she lucky, Hamish? Is she fortunate to have a creature like me in pursuit?
That's entirely up to you. Just remember, no secrets. Not if you love her.
Matthew looked into his queen's serene face, his fingers closing protectively around the small carved figure. He was still holding it when the sun rose, long after Hamish had gone to sleep. Chapter 10. Still trying to shake the ice from my shoulders left by Matthew's stare, I opened the door to my rooms. Inside, the answering machine greeted me with a flashing red 13. There were 9 additional voicemail messages on my mobile. All of them were from Sarah, and reflected an escalating concern about what her sixth sense told her was happening in Oxford. Unable to face my all-too-prescient aunts, I turned down the volume on the answering machine, turned off the ringers on both phones, and climbed wearily into bed. Next morning, when I passed through the porter's lodge for a run, Fred waved a stack of message slips at me.
"I'll pick them up later,"
I called, and he flashed his thumb in acknowledgement. My feet pounded on familiar dirt pads through the fields and marshes north of the city, the exercise helping to keep at bay both my guilt over not calling my aunts and the memory of Matthew's cold face. Back in college, I collected the messages and threw them into the trash. Then I staved off the inevitable call home with cherished weekend rituals, boiling an egg, brewing tea, gathering laundry, piling up the drifts of paper that littered every surface. After I'd wasted most of the morning, there was nothing left to do but call New York. It was early there, but there was no chance that anyone was still in bed.
"What do you think you're up to, Diana?" Sarah demanded in lieu of hello.
"Good morning, Sarah." I sank into the armchair by the defunct fireplace and crossed my feet on a nearby bookshelf. This was going to take a while.
"It is not a good morning," Sarah said tartly. "We've been beside ourselves. What's going on?"
Em picked up the extension. "Hi, Em," I said, recrossing my legs. This was going to take a long while.
"Is that vampire bothering you?" Em asked anxiously.
"Not exactly."
"We know you've been spending time with vampires and demons," my aunt broke in impatiently. "Have you lost your mind, or is something seriously wrong?"
"I haven't lost my mind, and nothing's wrong." The last bit was a lie, but I crossed my fingers and hoped for the best.
"Do you really think you're going to fool us? You cannot lie to a fellow witch," Sarah exclaimed, out with it, Diana.
So much for that plan.
Let her speak, Sarah, M said. We trust Diana to make the right decisions, remember?
The ensuing silence led me to believe that this had been a matter of some controversy. Sarah drew in her breath, but M cut her off.
Where were you last night?
Yoga. There was no way of squirming out of this inquisition, but it was to my advantage to keep all responses brief and to the point.
Yoga? Sarah asked, incredulous. Why are you doing yoga with those creatures? You know it's dangerous to mix with demons and vampires.
The class was led by a witch.
I became indignant, seeing Amira's serene, lovely face before me.
This yoga class, was it his idea?
Em asked.
Yes. It was at Claremont's house.
Sarah made a disgusted sound.
Told you it was him, Em muttered to my aunt. She directed her next words to me. I see a vampire standing between you and something. I'm not sure what exactly.
And I keep telling you, Emily Mather, that's nonsense. Vampires don't protect witches.
Sarah's voice was crisp with certainty.
This one does, I said.
What?
Em asked, and Sarah shouted.
He has been for days.
I bit my lip, unsure how to tell the story, then plunged in. Something happened at the library. I called up a manuscript and it was bewitched. There was silence.
A bewitched book?
Sarah's voice was keen with interest.
Was it a grimoire?
She was an expert on grimoires, and her most cherished possession was the ancient volume of spells that had been passed down in the Bishop family.
I don't think so, I said. All that was visible were alchemical illustrations.
What else?
My aunt knew that the visible was only the beginning when it came to bewitched books.
Someone's put a spell on the manuscript's text. There were faint lines of writing, layers upon layers of them, moving underneath the surface of the pages.
In New York, Sarah put down her coffee mug with a sharp sound.
Was this before or after Matthew Claremont appeared?
Before, I whispered.
You didn't think this was worth mentioning when you told us you'd met a vampire?
Sarah did nothing to disguise her anger.
By the goddess, Diana, you can be so reckless. How was this book bewitched? And don't tell me you don't know.
It smelled funny. It felt wrong. At first I couldn't lift the book's cover. I put my palm on it. I turned my hand over on my lap, recalling the sense of instant recognition between me and the manuscript, half expecting to see the shimmer that Matthew had mentioned.
And?
Sarah asked. It tingled against my hand, then sighed and relaxed. I could feel it through the leather and the wooden boards.
How did you manage to unravel this spell? Did you say any words? What were you thinking?
Sarah's curiosity was now thoroughly roused.
There was no witchcraft involved, Sarah. I needed to look at the book for my research, and I laid my palm flat on it, that's all.
I took a deep breath. Once it was open, I took some notes, closed it, and returned the manuscript.
You returned it?
There was a loud clatter as Sarah's phone hit the floor. I winced and held the receiver away from my head, but her colorful language was still audible.
Diana, M said faintly, are you there?
I'm here, I said sharply.
Diana Bishop, you know better.
Sarah's voice was reproachful.
How could you send back a magical object you didn't fully understand?
My aunt had taught me how to recognize enchanted and bewitched objects, and what to do with them. You were to avoid touching or moving them until you knew how their magic worked. Spells could be delicate, and many had protective mechanisms built into them.
What was I supposed to do, Sarah?
I could hear my defensiveness.
Refused to leave the library until you could examine it? It was a Friday night. I wanted to go home.
What happened when you returned it? Sarah said tightly.
The air might have been a little funny, I admitted, and the library might have given the impression it shrank for just a moment.
You sent the manuscript back, and the spell reactivated, Sarah said. She swore again. Few witches are adept enough to set up a spell that automatically resets when it's broken. You're not dealing with an amateur.
That's the energy that drew them to Oxford, I said, suddenly understanding. It wasn't my opening the manuscript. It was the resetting of the spell.
The creatures aren't just at yoga, Sarah. I'm surrounded by vampires and demons in the Bodleian. Claremont came to the library on Monday night, hoping to catch a glimpse of the manuscript after he heard two witches talking about it. By Tuesday, the library was crawling with them.
Here we go again, Sarah said with a sigh. Before the month's out, demons will be showing up in Madison looking for you.
There must be witches you can rely on for help.
Em was making an effort to keep her voice level, but I could hear the concern in it.
There are witches, I said haltingly, but they're not helpful. A wizard in a brown tweed coat tried to force his way into my head. He would have succeeded, too, if not for Matthew.
The vampire put himself between you and another witch?
Em was horrified. That's not done. You never interfere in business between witches if you're not one of us.
You should be grateful.
I might not want to be lectured by Claremont or have breakfast with him again, but the vampire deserved some credit.
If he hadn't been there, I don't know what would have happened. No witch has ever been so invasive with me before.
Maybe you should get out of Oxford for a while, Em suggested.
I'm not going to leave because there's a witch with no manners in town.
Em and Sarah whispered to each other, their hands over the receivers.
I don't like this one bit, my aunt finally said in the tone that suggested that the world was falling apart.
Bewitched books? Demons following you? Vampires taking you to yoga? Witches threatening a bishop? Witches are supposed to avoid notice, Diana. Even the humans are going to know something's going on.
If you stay in Oxford, you'll have to be more inconspicuous, Em agreed. There's nothing wrong with coming home for a while and letting the situation cool off, if that becomes impossible. You don't have the manuscript anymore. Maybe they'll lose interest.
None of us believed that was likely.
I'm not running away.
You wouldn't be,
Em protested.
I would.
And I wasn't going to display a shred of cowardice so long as Matthew Claremont was around.
He can't be with you every minute of every day, honey, Em said sadly, hearing my unspoken thoughts.
I should think not, Sarah said darkly.
I don't need Matthew Claremont's help. I can take care of myself, I retorted.
Diana, that vampire isn't protecting you out of the goodness of his heart, Em said. You represent something he wants. You have to figure out what it is.
Maybe he is interested in alchemy. Maybe he's just bored.
Vampires do not get bored, Sarah said crisply. Not when there's a witch's blood around.
There was nothing to be done about my aunt's prejudices. I was tempted to tell her about yoga class, where for over an hour I'd been gloriously free from fear of other creatures. But there was no point.
Enough. I was firm. Matthew Claremont won't get any closer, and you needn't worry about me fiddling with more bewitched manuscripts. But I'm not leaving Oxford, and that's final.
All right, Sarah said. But there's not much we can do from here if things go wrong.
I know, Sarah.
And the next time you get handed something magical, whether you expected it or not, behave like the witch you are, not some silly human. Don't ignore it or tell yourself you're imagining things.
Willful ignorance and dismissing the supernatural were at the top of Sarah's list of human pet peeves. Treat it with respect, and if you don't know what to do, ask for help.
Promise, I said quickly, wanting to get off the phone. But Sarah wasn't through yet. I never thought I'd see the day when a bishop relied on a vampire for protection rather than her own power, she said. My mother must be turning in her grave.
This is what comes from avoiding who you are, Diana. You've got a mess on your hands, and it's all because you thought you could ignore your heritage. It doesn't work that way.
Sarah's bitterness soured the atmosphere in my room long after I'd hung up the phone. The next morning, I stretched my way through some yoga poses for half an hour and then made a pot of tea. Its vanilla and floral aromas were comforting, and it had just enough caffeine to keep me from dozing in the afternoon without keeping me awake at night. After the leaves steeped, I wrapped the white porcelain pot in a towel to hold in the heat and carried it to the chair by the fireplace reserved for my deep thinking. Calmed by the tea's familiar scent, I pulled my knees up to my chin and reviewed my week. No matter where I started, I found myself returning to my last conversation with Matthew Claremont. Had my efforts to prevent magic from seeping into my life and work meant nothing? Whenever I was stuck with my research, I imagined a white table, gleaming and empty, and the evidence as a jigsaw puzzle that needed to be pieced together. It took the pressure off and felt like a game. Now I tumbled everything from the past week onto that table. Ashmole 782, Matthew Claremont, Agatha Wilson's wandering attention, the Tweedy Wizard, my tendency to walk with my eyes closed, the creatures in the Bodleian, how I'd fetched notes and queries from the shelf, Amira's yoga class. I swirled the bright pieces around, putting some together and trying to form a picture, but there were too many gaps, and no clear image emerged. Sometimes picking up a random piece of evidence helped me figure out what was most important. Putting my imaginary fingers on the table, I drew out a shape, expecting to see Ashmole 782. Matthew Claremont's dark eyes looked back at me. Why was this vampire so important? The pieces of my puzzle started to move of their own volition, swirling in patterns that were too fast to follow. I slapped my imaginary hands on the table, and the pieces stopped their dance. My palms tingled with recognition. This didn't seem like a game anymore. It seemed like magic. And if it was, then I'd been using it in my schoolwork, in my college courses, and now in my scholarship. But there was no room in my life for magic, and my mind closed resolutely against the possibility that I'd been violating my own rules without knowing it. The next day, I arrived in the library's cloakroom at my normal time, went up the stairs, rounded the corner near the collection desk, and braced myself to see him. Claremont wasn't there.
"Do you need something?"
Miriam said in an irritable voice, scraping her chair against the floor as she stood.
"Where is Professor Claremont?"
"He's hunting,"
Miriam said, eyes snapping with dislike.
"In Scotland."
"Hunting?" I swallowed hard.
"Oh, when will he be back?"
"I honestly don't know, Dr. Bishop."
Miriam crossed her arms and put out a tiny foot. "I was hoping he'd take me to yoga at the old lodge tonight," I said faintly, trying to come up with a reasonable excuse for stopping. Miriam turned and picked up a ball of black fluff. She tossed it at me, and I grabbed it as it flew by my hip.
"You left that in his car on Friday."
"Thank you." My sweater smelled of carnations and cinnamon.
"You should be more careful with your things," Miriam muttered. "You're a witch, Dr. Bishop. Take care of yourself and stop putting Matthew in this impossible situation."
I turned on my heel without comment and went to pick up my manuscripts from Sean. "Everything all right?" he asked, eyeing Miriam with a frown.
"Perfectly."
I gave him my usual seat number, and when he still looked concerned, a warm smile.
"How dare Miriam speak to me like that?" I fumed, while settling into my workspace.
My fingers itched as if hundreds of insects were crawling under the skin. Tiny sparks of blue-green were arcing between my fingertips, leaving traces of energy as they erupted from the edges of my body. I clenched my hands and quickly sat on top of them. This was not good. Like all members of the university, I'd sworn an oath not to bring fire or flame into Bodley's library. The last time my fingers had behaved like this, I was 13 and the fire department had to be called to extinguish the blaze in the kitchen. When the burning sensation abated, I looked around carefully and sighed with relief. I was alone in the Selden End. No one had witnessed my fireworks display. Pulling my hands from underneath my thighs, I scrutinized them for further signs of supernatural activity. The blue was already diminishing to a silver gray as the power retreated from my fingertips. I opened the first box, only after ascertaining I wouldn't set fire to it, and pretended that nothing unusual had happened. Still, I hesitated to touch my computer for fear that my fingers would fuse to the plastic keys.
Not surprisingly, it was difficult to concentrate, and that same manuscript was still before me at lunchtime. Maybe some tea would calm me down. At the beginning of term, one would expect to see a handful of human readers in Duke Humphrey's medieval wing. Today there was only one, an elderly human woman examining an illuminated manuscript with a magnifying glass. She was squashed between an unfamiliar demon and one of the female vampires from last week. Gillian Chamberlain was there, too, glowering at me along with four other witches, as if I'd let down our entire species. Hurrying past, I stopped at Miriam's desk. "I presume you have instructions to follow me to lunch. Are you coming?" She put down her pencil with exaggerated care. "After you." Miriam was in front of me by the time I reached the back staircase. She pointed to the steps on the other side. "Go down that way." "Why? What difference does it make?"
"Suit yourself," she shrugged.
One flight down, I glanced through the small window stuck into the swinging door that led to the upper reading room, and I gasped. The room was full to bursting with creatures. They had segregated themselves. One long table held nothing but demons, conspicuous because not a single book, open or closed, sat in front of them. Vampires sat at another table, their bodies perfectly still and their eyes never blinking. The witches appeared studious, but their frowns were signs of irritation rather than concentration, since the demons and vampires had staked out the tables closest to the staircase.
"No wonder we're not supposed to mix. No human could ignore this," Miriam observed. "What have I done now?" I asked in a whisper.
"Nothing. Matthew's not here," she said matter-of-factly.
"Why are they so afraid of Matthew?"
"You'll have to ask him. Vampires don't tell tales, but don't worry," she continued, baring her sharp white teeth. "These work perfectly, so you've got nothing to fear."
Shoving my hands into my pockets, I clattered down the stairs, pushing through the tourists in the quadrangle. At Blackwell's, I swallowed a sandwich and a bottle of water. Miriam caught my eye as I passed by her on the way to the exit. She put aside a murder mystery and followed me.
"Diana,"
she said quietly as we passed through the library's gates.
"What are you up to?"
"None of your business," I snapped. Miriam sighed. Back in Duke Humphrey's, I located the wizard in brown tweed. Miriam watched intently from the center aisle, still as a statue.
"Are you in charge?"
He tipped his head to the side in acknowledgement. "I'm Diana Bishop," I said, sticking out my hand.
"Peter Knox, and I know very well who you are. You're Rebecca and Stephen's child."
He touched my fingertips lightly with his own. There was a 19th-century grimoire sitting in front of him, a stack of reference books at his side. The name was familiar, though I couldn't place it, and hearing my parents' names come out of this wizard's mouth was disquieting. I swallowed hard. "Please clear your friends out of the library. The new students arrived today, and we wouldn't want to frighten them."
"If we could have a quiet word, Dr. Bishop, I'm sure we could come to some arrangement."
He pushed his glasses up over the bridge of his nose. The closer I was to Knox, the more danger I felt. The skin under my fingernails started to prickle ominously.
"You have nothing to fear from me," he said sorrowfully. "That vampire, on the other hand..."
"You think I found something that belongs to the witches," I interrupted. "I no longer have it. If you want Ashmole 782, there are request slips on the desk in front of you."
"You don't understand the complexity of the situation."
"No, and I don't want to. Please leave me alone."
"Physically, you are very like your mother."
Knox's eyes swept over my face.
"But you have some of Stephen's stubbornness as well, I see."
I felt the usual combination of envy and irritation that accompanied a witch's references to my parents or family history, as if they had an equal claim to mine.
"I'll try," he continued, "but I don't control those animals."
He waved across the aisle, where one of the scary sisters was watching Knox and me with interest. I hesitated and crossed over to her seat.
I'm sure you heard our conversation, and you must know I'm under the direct supervision of two vampires already, I said. You're welcome to stay, if you don't trust Matthew and Miriam, but clear the others out of the upper reading room.
Witches are hardly ever worth a moment of a vampire's time, but you are full of surprises today, Diana Bishop. Wait until I tell my sister Clarissa what she's missed.
The female vampire's words came out in a lush, unhurried drawl, redolent of impeccable breeding and a fine education. She smiled, teeth gleaming in the low light of the medieval wing.
Challenging Nox, a child like you. What a tale I'll have to tell.
I dragged my eyes away from her flawless features and went off in search of a familiar demonic face. The latte-loving demon was drifting around the computer terminals, wearing headphones and humming under his breath to some unheard music as the end of the cord was swinging freely around the tops of his thighs. Once he pulled the white plastic discs from his ears, I tried to impress upon him the seriousness of the situation.
"Look,"